Welcome to Formidable Wolf on Food and Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
And it's funny, Cindy, once upon a time, we had a staffer at a restaurant years ago take a quiz. And one of the questions on the quiz were, what are the three basic elements of Chef Wolf's cuisine? And there were a lot of proper answers on these quizzes, you know. It was a time when it was very focused on low country cooking and fresh product, and that's still true, and that's still true, and French technique. But this fellow, his answer was poke, poke, and mo-poke. If he didn't have all the proper academic answers, he at least could get to the soul of it.
Yeah, that was a very, very, very long time ago. That would have been Savannah, which we can say out loud since it doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But
I do have strong roots in Southern cooking, partly because I lived in the South when I was little, but mostly because I have a great interest in the place where I did my apprenticeship, which is in Charleston, South Carolina. And, you know, that food, that foundation of that cooking is based on Native American principles and West African cooking and Western European cooking. And thankfully, a lot of hogs were brought over to the United States during the time of settlement. By the European settlers, so we have a lot of hogs to work with.
But in the end, if you read those old recipe books and you see them called receipt books, you know that pretty much inevitably there is some bacon or some
fatback
or a hog maw or some kind of a, you know, split pork bone, something that has slipped into just about every recipe to make sure that there is flavor in the dish.
Absolutely. I mean, it's just a huge part of American, the foundation of American cooking, between that and corn and rice.
But when you think about all the different people that came to the States, just about everybody brought some tradition. You talk about American cuisine being a melting pot cuisine and regional influence, but pretty much everywhere someone brought something.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm sure that Boston baked beans, they had sense enough to have bacon fat involved in those.
Well, it's inexpensive. I mean, that's how it was and still continues to be more, you know, it's easier for people to get a hold of pork and work with it. So, you know, I think one of the things that's really important about understanding cooking is that you need foundations upon which you build. So if you have a great stock, you can make a great sauce. If you have a great stock, you can make a delicious soup. If you may have a great stock, you can braise something. And those things come from meat and bones and pork. We don't really think too much of pork stock, but we do make smoked ham hock stock, and that really gives you a tremendous amount of flavor because not only does it have pork in it, but it also has the smoked flavor aspect, which we are very fond of in the United States. Something that's been smoked.
You know, the old Spanish trick that we used at Puzzle in the beginning to make the house stock was sort of a forever. It was a chicken and veal stock, but we always used a pig's foot because there's so much jelly in
there's
that pig's foot.
There's a ton of gelatin in the
and,
feet.
And very good flavor in the feet of the pigs.
Yeah, which is why you also use shanks. There's just a lot of gelatin in that area of the animal. So those things are great for making beautifully viscous sauces.
But all these years of using pork to get the flavor we want to get into dishes, you find out over time that with everything, if you want great tomatoes, you got to be very specific. If you want great Chateauneuf du Pape, you've got to be very specific. If you want great flavor coming from pork, you've got to be very specific. And for us, we've been looking for a long time for a local producer of pork that raised natural animals, that raise a heritage breed, and we have a fellow coming on. And we'll let him talk about those things.
Yeah, we need to talk about, and I really want people to understand what does a heritage breed mean and how are these small farmers, you know, handling their animals and how are they fed? How are they free to roam around? You know, how do they live? Because the quality of life for the animal greatly affects the animal, obviously, and therefore the way that the food tastes, the product tastes, and affects, and the health of the animal affects our health, as we all now know very, very well. So we need healthy, happy, quite frankly, animals, these animals that are being raised to be eaten. They deserve to have a high quality of life. And frankly, they are being raised to be eaten, so we do want them to taste the best they can taste.
Yeah, you get no flavor otherwise.
Right. And if they're under stress, that also affects the quality of the meat. So this is the reality. You know, farming is a business, but it's also a way.
Well, it's a quality oriented business.
Yeah, it's a business that handles lives, animals' lives. So it has to be handled in a certain way. So I'm really anxious to talk with Brian from Wagon Wheel to see, you know, exactly how they feed their animals and why. I just want to hear what he has to say. I think it's going to be fascinating.
What breeds they have. I mean, that's something that we've used a little bit of product from them, and it's been excellent. We've used from a variety of different producers, but this is the first local one. They're up in Mount Airy that we've gotten fresh product on a consistent basis and have been really happy with the flavor, the moisture, the finish of the product. Good. It's actually, there's a T-bone that we're using that just has great flavor.
Well, what it comes back to from the beginning of your conversation is that with a lot of things that we are doing now with food, whether it's understanding heirloom seeds and using, you know, now everybody says heirloom tomatoes, you know, using the original, the beginning of the seed and really not something that's been changed or modified. And that is what has the flavor. That is what truly has beauty. That's what does have when, as you say, the sun shines on it, that it produces something that tastes absolutely amazing. There's nothing better than a fantastic tomato that was just picked off the vine. And frankly, there's nothing better than having a great piece of meat that has been handled correctly and fed correctly. So, you know.
And maybe it's not giant.
And the original breed of the animal.
And maybe it's not giant, and maybe it's not as tender as breed X.
Or, yeah, it's not been crossbred
let's begin with flavor.
Right, right. It's all about the farming of the animal. So let's talk to a farmer.
And so to that point, we have with us Brian Shiner from Wagon Wheel Ranch in Mount Airy. Brian, how are you this morning?
I'm good. How are you?
Hi, Brian. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, Cindy.
We're good. We're already starting to get hungry. That's kind of what happens on these programs. So what is your favorite dish that you've had made with pork from your farm?
A sausage. We eat a lot of spaghetti and sausage, so I guess I would have to say that.
And you grind the sausage yourself?
No, we don't do it here at the farm. It's done at the USDA butcher.
Okay, very good.
So I know Cindy has giant interest in the heritage breed animals. You want to tell us about what it is that you're growing and how you grow it and exactly where you are, how big of a crop is typical for you guys in the course of a year?
We switched to Berkshire pigs about 4 or 5 years ago. And basically that was, we were at a taste test, and it was the commercial hogs and it was the heritage hogs, the ones that have been around for a very long time. And the difference in the taste was just amazing. I had no idea that, I never at that point even heard of Berkshire and didn't know that there was that big of a taste in the hogs. What happened is the majority of Berkshires are raised in the Midwest, and they had a contract with Japan. In Japan, they have Wagyu cattle, which in America we call it Kobe beef because it comes from the town of Kobe. Mm-hmm. But the cattle are actually called Wagyu. And in Japan, they call Berkshires Kabuto, which translates to black pig. Mm-hmm. And it's on the same level as Kobe beef there. They just had this huge desire. There became an issue, which doesn't really matter to go into now, but an issue with the contract with Japan. And the American Berkshire Association was formed, and they went to chefs in major markets and had them try the Berkshires. And that's where the whole movement started in America, was to the chefs. They wanted it, and people like me and other small farms started raising them for him, and then it's now become pretty big in the United States. Sure. You know, a lot of people now are understanding the difference in the taste, and that with Berkshire, they actually marble like a cow marbles, like beef marbles, which is the only breed that does that. A big part of the taste of pork is what they're fed. You could take a heritage breed, or you could take a Berkshire hog and put them in a commercial facility, and you're not going to get the same taste as from a free-range farm like us. Ours are in the barn until they're about 60, 70 pounds, and then they're out in the woods for the rest of their life. So when it's not freezing cold out, they're digging to get roots and bugs. We're a completely vegetarian diet for our hogs, but they do eat bugs and insects, so that they eat that naturally, versus the commercial places where they're feeding the meat scraps to. Anything that is not used from, for instance, from a cow, if it's not used for human consumption, it's then fed to the pigs. It's just a cheaper way to feed them.
We always notice at one of our places we get the T-bones from you guys, and we just always notice a cleaner flavor, more pure flavor from the pork.
Yeah, and that comes from, with the pigs, most people don't realize that they eat grass. We can put them in a pasture, and they'll mow that pasture down just like a cow or the sheep will. So they do eat the grass. They do eat certain weeds. They dig up and eat things, and we do supplement their diet. They do have access to feed, but they're probably, you know, our feed is, again, it's all vegetarian. It's like sweet potatoes is a good example of what we're feeding them. We buy the peanuts that don't make it for being bagged and sold as peanuts to the public. They're an odd size, or mm-hmm. the shell's broken, or something like that. So we're looking always for, you know, any kind of nuts or fruit or vegetables that we can feed them that are natural. And again, usually we're buying seconds. It could be sweet potatoes that have scratches in them, or an apple that has little damage because it was at the bottom of the box or something like that. Versus, again, the commercial industry where they're feeding feed scraps. And in any commercial hog facility, there's antibiotics in the feed that has to be, because they're being raised indoors and they would all get sick. So instead of them taking a chance, they feed them antibiotics. The problem with that is if you have a sick animal and you feed it the antibiotics, its body's going to use those chemicals to cure it. If you feed the antibiotics to a healthy animal, it doesn't need to use them. It stays in the blood. And then when you eat that, you're getting, it's a small amount, but you are getting some of the antibiotics. And the American Medical Association says that's a problem, because there hasn't been a new antibiotic invented in 20 years or 22 years now, and they're afraid that Americans, because of all of the antibiotics put in our meat when they're raised, is going to cause a problem. It's going to cause resistance to the antibiotics.
I'm just curious, in raising the hogs, so you said the first up to 60 pounds they're in the barn, and then they go out into the woods, so it's, they can handle the weather, they just pretty well stay out there until we have a couple of feet of snow, and then you bring them back in the barn? Or what do you, I'm just kind of thinking about, you know, farmers today and what you all must be going through with snowstorm.
The last 2 days, we've been doing nothing but moving animals to where they could have some shelter. Where the hogs are in the woods, they have a shelter in there, so they can go in and out on their own. It's a three-sided shelter, so there's no front to it. So they go in if they want to get out of the rain or the wind, or coming up the snow, they'll just go into their shelter. But they don't mind the snow. They're like little kids. They play in it. They put their noses down and make trails, and they look like children after playing in the snow. What the animals can handle is ice. That's when we have our biggest problems. And at that point, if we're going to get ice, which we haven't really got that much of that in Maryland, then we do have to move them inside for that. So getting back to the diet and how we raise them, it takes us about 8 months, 8 to 9 months for one of our Berkshire hogs to be mature enough to go to the butcher. In the commercial industry, it's 3 months. They have them where they don't move at all. They're in small stalls, and they're just fed. So all they do is sleep, eat, and stress out. Where on farms like mine, they're running around the woods. Again, they play like children. They're out there running around, digging things up. They can take a nasty section of a wooded area and turn it into a beautiful park. Wow. By getting rid of everything that's nasty in there. And we do use it for that also. We'll put goats into overgrown fields and have them eat everything they can. Then we'll put the pigs in there and they'll dig everything up. And when they're done, now we have a pasture that we can seed with grass. The fact that they're outside and running around puts it so that they're not stressed. When an animal's stressed, just like when you're stressed, if you're stressed, you sort of get that feeling in your stomach, your body releases a chemical, and you might have like a knot in your stomach or the feeling of being stressed. That's a huge problem with the pigs, and that's why a lot of them die in the confinement. We've never had a pig die out in the woods. It's never happened, and we have never treated a pig with antibiotics. We just have never had the need to do that. What is concerning in America is that now 70% of all the antibiotics produced or sold in the United States goes to the livestock industry. Only 30% goes to humans, and that's a huge problem that is building resistance to these antibiotics. That's part of the health reasons of it. But again, the taste has a lot to do with what they're being fed. And by just giving them a vegetation diet, it's just a better taste for the pork.
How many pigs do you raise in the course of a year?
Last year we did 260 pigs. And that's about, we can do about 300, and then we would need to get some more land to rent another farm for it. We're at this point doing around 260. This year, maybe a little bit more of that.
Brian, if it's okay, we're going to need to take a little quick break.
Okay.
And then come back to you in the next segment. And this is Foreman and Wolf on WYPR on Food and Wine.